is 19-3135, United States v. Golightly. Would appellant's counsel make her appearance and proceed?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Paige Nichols, and I represent Mr. Golightly, the appellant. I do plan to try to reserve 3 or 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal. I understand that's my responsibility. We've raised 4 issues in the brief, but I plan to begin with and focus on issue number 2 because I think that one is the most complicated issue. That is the issue that asks whether we have a felony triggering verdict or multiple felony triggering verdicts on each of counts 1 through 7 of the computer damage counts. What we have is not a proper felony triggering verdict. It is instead a free-floating loss finding that is untethered to any particular count and that doesn't match the statute. So what do I mean by that? I struggle a little bit with where to start here because the government and the defense are so far apart in our views of the statute and what it takes to make a felony conviction of computer damage. And so I'm going to start with our most basic point, just to make sure we're all on the same page here. I trust that if the court thinks I'm moving too slowly, you'll jump me up to what we really need to talk about. But our most basic proposition is that computer damage is a misdemeanor conviction, unless the defendant has particular priors, which he doesn't have here, or unless the jury finds unanimously and beyond a reasonable doubt for every count the existence of a felony triggering element. Here, the felony triggering element is loss. And so Mr. Golightly could not be found guilty of felonies and could not be sentenced for felony, certainly not 7 counts of felony computer damage, absent a proper jury verdict on the essential element of loss. So what is a proper verdict on loss? We start with the statute. The statute allows the government to prove felony computer damage by showing loss in one of 2 different ways. The statute defines 2 different kinds of loss. First, the statute is oddly written, but it has one kind of loss inside the parenthetical and one kind of loss outside the parenthetical.
Are you talking about Section I now?
Yes. And so, yes, Section little I.
Little I.
Yes.
Yeah.
I recently learned the word Romanette, so apparently it's Romanette I, capital I. So once we get into that section, and it's important to read the introductory language to that section, which tells us that we have the felony conviction if the offense caused, the offense, singular, caused loss to one or more persons during any 1-year period, aggregating at least $5,000. That's one kind of loss. The second kind of loss looks at relevant conduct, looks beyond the offense, singular, and asks whether there's loss resulting from a related course of conduct affecting one or more other protected computers. And the problem, one of the problems with the instructions in the verdict form here is that these 2 separate kinds of loss were sort of mashed up together, but they weren't completely mashed up together. So it's not as if the government was required by the district court to show both types of loss, but the district court's instruction and verdict form made it easier for the jury to find loss to one or more persons by engrafting onto that the course of conduct idea from the parenthetical type of loss.
And your position is there's no evidence to support the parenthetical type loss, so it never should have been presented to the jury in the first place. Is that right? Or is that too broad?
It's close. Their
related course of conduct has to affect one or more other protected computers, and you're saying that was never charged in this case, the one or more protected computers. We only have one.
Right.
My understanding is you were saying the parenthetical really just simply didn't apply here.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part of that question.
My understanding is you were basically arguing that the parenthetical language simply didn't apply as to the related course of conduct because of the lack of one or more computers, but I might be looking at that too simplistically.
No, that is basically the argument, that given the charge, given the instructions that the parties asked for, and given the structure of the statute, that what was at issue here was the first kind of loss, the extra parenthetical kind of loss here. And it wasn't until the instructions conference that the judge proposed adding this aggregate language or the any interrelated to any of counts 1 through 7 language. So that's the first problem is the way that the parenthetical part of the parenthetical type of loss gets added on to the first kind of loss. The second problem is that we don't know, we don't have any particular counts that we know the jury unanimously made a finding as to. The judge asked them whether they find that the conduct related to any of counts 1 through 7 caused this aggregate loss. And the unanimity instruction only obligated them to be unanimous as to this aggregate part of loss, but not as to any particular count.
And
so
why does it necessarily have to be? I mean, the statute by definition talks about aggregate loss. I mean, why is that necessary? I mean, you've got, and let me ask two questions. Why is it necessary? And the second is, I want to get clear why the parenthetical in your mind is inapposite here.
Okay, so the first question is,
let me restate it so I may not have been clear. It seems to me by the language of the statute, which speaks in terms of loss during any 1 year period, and by virtue of the term aggregate of at least $5,000, that on its face, it doesn't contemplate a one-hit transaction. It is not a discrete matter. And therefore, it seems to me on its face, the notion that we just look, we focus on one count and we focus on what the conduct at play in one count would seem not to fit what's going on here.
Okay. So the way I read this, and I think that the statutory construction and history supports this, that the introductory language says if the offense caused loss to one or more persons. So the thing that gets aggregated is across persons who suffer a loss. So you might have a computer hacking that affects multiple customers of a website because their personal information is lost or something like that. Or you might have a single hack that affects a company, but it continues to experience loss resulting from that single hack over time for the course of a year. So those are the things that get aggravated. It's across persons and across time, but only for one count, one offense. And that's supported by the Senate report that I cited in, I think it's in the opening brief. And it's supported by the context because we don't have this related course of conduct language in the statute until Congress adds the parenthetical. And they didn't add it also to the extra parenthetical part of the statute. And
the parenthetical relates to criminal prosecutions, right?
Yes.
So, in fact, there are civil cases which have allowed for exactly the opposite of what you're talking about, right? They've allowed for the aggregation of loss relative to in a way that wouldn't relate to one specific instance, right?
I'm not sure I've seen those cases. And what happens in the civil cases is a little bit different because the civil provision of the statute, which is subsection G of the statute, speaks in terms of conduct. You can only file a civil suit if the conduct involves one of the factors set forth in this subsection that we're talking about. So the civil cases might play out a little bit differently because they're focused on conduct, not a single offense, like we're focused on here because of the language, the offense.
Okay. All right. So you're saying that offense in some sense narrows the scope and that we're tied to the offense. All right. Well, for the moment, let's deal with that as being your response to the first question. The second question is, why on its face does this parenthetical not, number one, you speak of it as two different ways to have loss. Well, the parent, it's joined with a conjunctively with the other kind, but let's just, why does that parenthetical not on its face contemplate this sort of aggregation across counts that we're talking about here?
Because of the way the statute is structured with that, that language set off in the parenthetical, because the parenthetical wasn't added until later, it was added in 2001 in the Patriot Act. And there's no reason to think it was added in order to increase the government's, so the and, addressing the and is a little curious, I agree, but if the and really operated as an and, then the government would be obligated to prove both types of loss in order to get a felony computer damage conviction. And I don't think there's any evidence that that's what Congress intended to increase the government's burden. I think Congress intended to give the government more options for getting a felony computer damage conviction. But I think I will probably just start repeating myself at this point. The reason that the parenthetical doesn't come into play here is because these are two separate kinds of loss. Now, I've also, as I've argued in the brief, the government never charged the language here of the entire parenthetical, never asked for the language of the entire parenthetical for the instructions, and the jury wasn't given that language. So we don't end up with felony verdicts. Now, I would like to reserve my time unless I need to answer another question before I do that.
That's fine.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'm Alan Metzger on behalf of the United States, and I was trial counsel in this matter, Your Honor. With respect to the defendant's argument is on the second issue, she makes the argument that there was, we couldn't get into the aggregate because there was not more than one or more other computers affected. However, the trial evidence, the trial testimony and Exhibit 52, which the government attached to its brief as Attachment 3, clearly indicates that more than one computer bank, more than one computer system at Nextech was affected by the defendant's conduct. The trial testimony was that their Nextech corporate had a set of computers, a separate set of computers from Nextech's classified, and that they served different functions. Exhibit 52, Attachment 3, was an exhibit testified to by one of the Nextech engineers that identified the periods of time that some of the computers were shut down. And because of the difference between the Nextech classified and the Nextech's corporate computers, the United States asked the witness to notate which of those attacks shut down the Nextech classified computers by designated across the top NTC, and which of those shut down the Nextech corporate computers by indicating corporate, and he did so. So those are clearly before the court.
Is there any evidence of damages, though, presented to the jury about the difference between these two computers? Isn't that what's important with respect to that parenthetical language? I think all of your damage evidence was kind of grouped together.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's because it was the defendant's conduct in causing the series of attacks that occurred against the Nextech computers between May 30, roughly almost 9 o'clock on May 30, and concluding in the early morning of April 2. Those series of DDoS attacks, you really couldn't distinguish because it was an ongoing response with ongoing identification. And so the United States did not distinguish between the attacks and what was done with each attack due to the language, the clear language of the statute that says that you can aggregate the loss from a course of conduct during a 1 year period of time.
Well, if you bite off on the on the defendant's argument here that you can't aggregate on a related course of conduct unless it involves one or more other protected computers, and that wasn't presented to the jury, so that you're only looking at a particular each offense individually in terms of aggregating the $5,000 in value, and as she says, perhaps there's more one or more persons who've experienced the loss, and that's how you might get there. But I guess what I'm saying is, if you bite off on the argument that it's per each offense that you've got to aggregate, what evidence did you have here of that?
Well, I don't believe that the statute indicates that it's per each offense. And Your Honor, given the statute, the structure of the statute, I think clearly refutes the argument being addressed by the defendant. Of particular note, A 1030 A5A and B are both identified as being a 10-year felony, subject to a 10-year term of imprisonment. Of note, 1030 A5C bears no distinction, no indication of what the penalty was. You then go to subparagraph C4G, and it says that, and so I don't misquote it, that a term of imprisonment for not more than 1 year for any other offense under subparagraph A5. So clearly the statute intends a violation of A5A as well as A5B as being a felony offense.
If the offense caused a harm provided in subclauses.
That goes to whether or not the loss can be aggregated across counts. I could not find any specific Tenth Circuit cases on this. However, there is, I did cite the United States versus Lanham case, which is an aggregation case that, as I indicated, was unpublished. And defendant's reply brief caused me to look further into some lenity cases. And United States versus Taylor, which I will supplement in the appropriate letter afterwards, is actually a case involving 18 U.S.C. 510C, which was the endorsement of a treasury check. And if the face amount or the aggregate value is more than $500, then it's a felony. And the Fifth Circuit held in United States versus Taylor that irrespective of the face value of the checks and irrespective of whether or not they were charged in one count or more counts, that the proper interpretation in that situation was when you aggregate, you can aggregate across counts. There's also a Tenth Circuit case, again, that I've found late, that is not directly on point, but I found interesting because it's a tax case. And it held that the unit of offense for a tax charge is each individual year. But when you consider course of conduct, that you can consider course of conduct across counts. And so I believe the case law is such that given the language of the statute and offense, that it is appropriate for the aggregate to be applied across counts, and it's not limited to a single or to each individual count. The instructions that the court gave and the instruction that the United States provided on this was not one that was in just made up by the United States. As noted in the government's brief, we provided to the court, and the court provided an instruction that predominantly came from the Eighth Circuit in their pattern instructions, and its jury verdict didn't require spoke of aggregation across all the counts and whether the aggregate loss during any one year to one or more persons was $5,000.
Well, I'm looking at the Eighth Circuit pattern instruction now, and it has an option that the district court did not include. It had language that said, did the defendant cause loss resulting from a related course of conduct affecting one or more protected computers of an aggregate value of $5,000 or more? That language does not appear in the district court's instruction. The district court's instruction actually, arguably along the lines of what the defendant said, mishmashes the question of loss with the question of damage to other computers, affecting one or more other protected computers. In other words, there is an option in that Eighth Circuit instruction that is not found in the instruction that the district court gave. I mean, the district court's instruction, I think, speaks of a guilty verdict caused by the aggregate loss to one or more persons during any 1 year period that totaled more than $5,000. And the specific language relating to damage to other authorized computers that appears in both the statute and in the Eighth Circuit instruction is not present in the district court's instruction. So what do we do with that? In other words, to the extent that they were borrowing from the Eighth Circuit, it was incomplete. So
and Your Honor, it may have been. I apologize. I wasn't able to pull that up as quickly as I had hoped I would be able to.
That's fine. If you got a general response, give it. If not, I want to touch on sufficiency of the evidence for a second.
Okay, let's go. I would suggest moving to sufficiency of the evidence.
Okay. I'm looking at the, having digested the reply brief of the defendant, I need to have a real understanding of why there isn't a problem there. I mean, because what you have, it seems to me, is a situation in which there's evidence to suggest that there was no email from the NetSucks and gmail.com. No email from that went to the NextText help desk, one. That email address was given as sort of a contact address. And that it appears that he accessed it from a question box, some drop-down box, when he sent the threat. And that would have been, so it would have been Kansas to Kansas. And if that's true, and then you had the forensic expert who testified that it appeared that his phone was used at the same time to send something to Nextech Classified. If all of that is true, then why isn't there an interstate commerce problem?
Your Honor, the defendant has misread the Exhibit 4A, which is the basis for this. First, in her reply brief, she states that the United States assumes that an email transmission occurred. In fact, there was testimony from Amy Normandin that the Exhibit 4A did contain, and the threats were received as a result of an email received from the defendant. Ms. Normandin's testimony is found at trial transcript page 306, 318, and 322, in which she specifically states that the threats were sent via email.
What I don't understand
they were sent by an email, but the Exhibit 4 says they were sent from NextTech Classified info at nextechclassified.com, which would be accessing the email on the website.
That's where the confusion arises from the defense, Your Honor. The testimony from Ms. Normandin when she introduced Exhibit 4A was that there were three means of communication that a person could engage with the NextTech help desk: telephone, email, or their web chat system. The header, the initial header on Exhibit 4A that the court just alluded to was reflecting communication from the help desk to their immediate superiors to determine what action, if any, they should take. When the court looks further, you'll see after that header among the NextTech employees is an indication of the contact email from ntsucks@mail.com. And 4B specifically identifies that threat came to NextTech by way of an email, and Ms. Normandin testified that the email was sent using the ntsucks@mail.com email address.
Even if you have an email sent, I guess I'm still struggling to see what evidence we have of a server outside the state of Kansas. There was none. No evidence of that was presented to the jury. And I understand you're relying on this little address at the bottom of on the copyright notice at the bottom of the email, which, assuming it was an email that was sent, you didn't give the jury any information to say that copyright notice somehow equates to knowing that we've got servers in Pennsylvania. I don't get how you get to the bottom line here.
Your Honor, you are correct in that the United States did not establish, did not specifically identify the location of the server used to send the email. The government is simply relying upon that this was raised in a Rule 29 situation, and the government's argument is that a reasonable inference can flow from the fact that mail.com is headquartered in Pennsylvania.
I don't get the inference there. I'm not a real high-tech person, but I do know that servers can be anywhere, and they don't necessarily equate with an address on an email.
We understand the court's concern, and the question is whether or not that is a reasonable inference. Mm-hmm. If that is a reasonable inference, it supports the overruling of the Rule 29 and the jury verdict. If the court determines that it's not reasonable, then we lose.
And let me, just to be clear, what would it have been about the mail.com address that would have led a reasonable jury, in your view, to infer that it came from Pennsylvania or it came from some interstate place?
The Exhibit 5 was the email communication between the defendant and mail.com creating and establishing the ntcsucks@mail email account.
Yes.
And that communication took place from Kansas to Chesterbrook, Pennsylvania.
And was there's evidence that says that?
The communication is between mail.com and the defendant. And so the direct answer to the simplest answer to the judge's question, I suppose, is there's not direct evidence saying that communication took place from the state of Kansas to the state of Pennsylvania, other than that's where mail.com is located.
But we know that, was there even evidence to say that's where mail.com is located?
I don't recall, Your Honor. I just don't recall.
All right. I appreciate the candor, and that's fine. Thank you very much for your argument. Your case is submitted. But we have some rebuttal time, and you went over like 3 minutes. So could you add on, Kevin, 3 minutes to her time? And you don't have to take it, but you have it. Please proceed.
Thank you. I do want to touch on at least three categories of arguments the government made. The first issue is other protected computers. The government says we had evidence of other protected computers, but our question isn't, was there evidence of other protected computers? I'm going to dispute that in a second. But the question really is, was there a verdict on other protected computers? And I think Your Honor, Judge Holmes pointed out, there was not a jury verdict on that because the jury wasn't asked to decide whether there was proof of other protected computers. And so any discussion about that, I think, is a discussion about harmless error, which the government hasn't raised with respect to the statutory problem here. Even if it had raised that issue, harmless error, well, first, I don't think the court should reach it because it's so complicated that this isn't that kind of case where the court should reach it. But I just want to point out that the definition of computer in the statute includes a data storage facility, which maybe the jury would have found equaled one server farm, which is what we had here. So the jury may well not have even found that there were other protected computers. Also, I think the word other suggests other than the ones affected by the counts of conviction. I don't want to go too far down that path because I think it takes us away from the real question, which is, do we have a proper verdict? And we definitely do not have a verdict on other protected computers. Next issue. The Eighth Circuit instructions, I'm really glad Your Honor brought those up. And I suggest that the court look closely at those instructions because the government says that district court followed them. And of course, the court has already pointed out, no, it didn't follow those instructions. Not only does the Eighth Circuit treat the loss element as two separate ways of proving loss, because if you look at the Eighth Circuit instructions, it says instruct on either loss to one or more persons or the parenthetical language, right? The Eighth Circuit does not mash them up. Second, the Eighth Circuit says if nobody's asking for a verdict on a lesser included offense of a misdemeanor, then you, the district court, ought to include loss as an essential element on the count elements themselves, which again is not what the district court did here. So the Eighth Circuit instructions are good models. And I don't know that we would have a complaint if the court had followed the Eighth Circuit instructions. Third, other cases. The government talks about Lanham. I think we responded to that in our reply brief, and I don't have a lot more to say about that, but I just want to emphasize that Lanham, in addition to being unpublished and out of circuit, and the question at issue was conceded by counsel, so it doesn't really do much good for this court. But Lanham was decided under a previous version of the statute. So it's just not a helpful case. Second, the Taylor case. Well, we addressed the Taylor case in our opening brief. And so I'll just refer the court back to the opening brief. There was a dissent first. Taylor was decided pre-Apprendi. So it has some problems, I think, some Apprendi problems in it. Second, there is a great dissent in Taylor by Judge Thornberry, and then in Lacoe, the Ninth Circuit agrees with Thornberry on the issue. But again, we're dealing with an entirely different statute. So then the third case that government talks about is a tax case that I don't know the name of because I haven't seen it cited yet, and the unit of prosecution. Well, I don't know what the tax code is in that case, so I can't really tell you how it's different, but I bet it's different. And what really matters is what is the language of this statute that Mr. Golightly was convicted of, and what should the jury verdict have looked like in this case to justify felony computer damage convictions? Now, I'm happy to answer any questions about the sufficiency question, but issue one, I'm not sure I can improve on the reply brief. So unless there are questions, I will cede the rest of my time, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it, counsel, for your fine arguments. Okay, submit it.